So head to our website to sign up to our mailing list or send your comments to our producers. Not my number though, yeah? All right, bye.
Welcome to the Jax Jones and Martin Warner Show. Today we're asking, can machines be as creative as humans? Exploring the world of computer-generated art with MIT's Nick Montford.
Nick Montford is the MIT professor for digital media. He's the brain behind 7 computer-generated books, many computer-generated poems, and is a leading figure in new media. Professor Nick, welcome to the Jax Jones and Martin Warner Show.
I guess before we kick off, and we're going to talk about generative art, or perhaps computer art. I think they're used synonymously, but you can correct us.
Yeah, there's sorts of fine details of terminology we can get into.
Did you say you're writing a book as well? So are you an author as well, Nick?
Yes, and I have several books of poetry, many of which are computer generated, and then I have books of scholarship, sort of. Different types of critical, theoretical engagements with digital media or new media.
Okay. So before we jump into that, perhaps you can just, in a couple of minutes, just tell us how you got to this point of being focused on digital media at large, but in particular, generative art. And obviously being in poetry and other forms of media, and they're also lean towards generative art. Just what's your background and why did you end up arriving at this point?
For me, I have a long-standing interest, almost since childhood, I'd say, in how computing, language, and literature come together to help us explore things that are culturally resonant, that are meaningful in terms of language, in terms of culture. So when I was growing up, there were these text adventure games, these interactive fiction games, and one of the very famous and top-selling ones was Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which would be familiar to you as a famous franchise. And these were in different literary genres. They came in mystery, science fiction, fantasy. They were sold in bookstores for a certain period of time. This was also a time when there were software stores. So you could go to the software store if you wanted to buy them, or you could go to the bookstore. And they were, for the stuff that you could buy and run on your home computer, they were really pretty advanced types of natural language processing. So they were clearly breaking some boundaries when it came to computing. But they were also literary works that were really compelling. And I did some work along these lines myself. I worked on some interactive fiction projects. But I'd say more importantly, interactive fiction is something that sort of gave me permission to see that the literary aspects of a work and the computational aspects of a work fit together. And I'm interested always in the cultural implications of computing and in how people use computing creatively, what they do as artists, broadly speaking. We talk about recording artists. We talk about, I'm not only talking about visual artists, people who are making creative use of different media. And so in a way, what's happening with generative art is people are working as computational artists. They're using computation as a medium. In my own case, I focus on literature and language. So I bring together work in the literary arts with work in the computational arts.
And it's probably worth at this point just let's grabbing for the listener and viewer, whether they're online on YouTube or listening to the extended audio, what generative art means. Mm-hmm. And perhaps also parallel with if there is in your mind a distinction between computer generated art and generative art, so we've got a somewhat complete taxonomy.
Yes, so there is a very complete taxonomy, a very useful one, and very precise, that's given by Margaret Bowden and Ernest Edmonds in their book From Fingers to Digits. And among the many terms they have, one of them is computer art or C art. One of them is generative art or G art. And then they have computer generative art, CG art. And so really, when we say, when I say generative art, when we talk about, you know, this is a show, Generative Unfoldings is a show of generative art, we're talking about computer generative art.
Right.
And that is work that is a software system. That's the thing that the artwork is, just like a painting is, you know, paint applied to a canvas, or it could be applied to a piece of wood or something like that. But in this case, we have a software system. That's what the artwork is. And there's certain qualities that it has. It has a degree of autonomy. So it does something to some extent on its own. And interestingly, we want to talk about the Generative Unfolding show. I know a lot of those pieces are interactive. And Bowden and Edmonds were willing to admit that there was stuff that was interactive that could be CG art, you know, or generative art. But the central examples, the stuff that was most core to their definition, was whatever ran on its own. So instead of having the artist make something, the artist made a system and that system did something on its own.
You kind of forgive me, Nick, for the layman example, but when you're talking about this stuff and computer generated art, a screensaver, a visualizer, or Windows 98, when you play the Windows Media Player, springs to mind.
Screensavers are great examples, I think. Right?
They really are.
Yeah.
Right?
No. Those are wonderful examples. And, you know, for instance, the Pipes screensaver from Windows 95, where those are. And so think about this in distinction from video art. When you look at it, you might say, well, this is video art because it's a moving image. It's presented on a screen. But video art is a particular closed system. It can run in a loop. It's going to show you the same thing every time. I don't mean to insult video art. Some of that can be very good, radical, and compelling.
For sure.
You know, but that's what it is. And the screensaver is always producing something new. If you, when that screensaver comes on every time, it's going to show you a different sequence of images because those images are generated. So screensavers are actually great examples, I think. There's also groups of screensaver hackers. You know, so Jamie Zarensky creating, you know, screensavers in this, you know, a free software framework where people can, you know, remake the Windows screensavers, but also contribute their own. And there's, and some of the classics, I think, of the 90s, like the Flying Toasters screensavers, you know, some of the classics of early computing, right, are works of this sort. Right. So they're great. And they're also, I mean, it's even better if they're useless, right? If they actually had a function to keep your monitor from having burn in, then you could possibly say, oh, well, you know, it's a utility of some sort. Right. Mm-hmm. But I was always interested to see, you know, where would you find the screensaver shelved in the software store? There was a category, there are games, and then there, it's not a game, right? And then there's a category for productivity software. Mm-hmm. It's not productivity software. It's not educational, right? Maybe it's counter-productivity software. So,
it's some utility.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a type of popular art.
Okay. So what it is, I'm about to sum up generative art.
Let's see it.
Much like, you know, you might use paint or other tools or other mediums. For generative art, it's the code is the canvas. And, you know, and that's how you communicate through the code, right? Okay, cool. I'm good so far. We're going through. I have screensaver. I have code. We're doing well, guys.
Well, and also the point of departure is that the hands come off the code or come off the keyboard in order to allow it to have some kind of autonomous nature to it. So it creates itself to some degree, right? So it's self-generating, right? Hence the word generative.
Is that essential to generative, that it has to have an AI component?
Well, I think what AI is exactly is an interesting question that has a different answer, you know, in 1956 when the term is first used, you know, going through the 50s, 60s, and then today. Mm-hmm. But there is an aspect of autonomy. The system does something. It's not simply producing what the author provided instructionally, you know, in exactly the same way. So there is instructional art of the sort that Saul LeWitt, you know, for instance, was very famous for devising. But these types of artwork, yeah, I mean, you can think about code being the canvas or the paint in this case.
Yeah.
And then also you can think about how there are, you know, utilitarian means of painting things. When you paint your house, you're going to get paint and you're putting it on the surface and you know, it's, you need to keep the water out. You've got certain utility for it, right? But generative art is using that for aesthetic purposes. It's changing the way that it's used. It is useful to think of, I think, generative art as sort of, you know, it's a screensaver off the chain. It's able to do something that takes that in a radical direction.
Screensaver is a fantastic example because we've just said it performs some level of utility, right? And that's that, you know, it's there to keep the screen moving and stop burnout, all the rest of it. But and certainly not today, by the way, in terms of displays.
That's right.
But they're pretty much useless. But let's just say that was the argument. It would actually say that it wasn't just for pleasure, as in art for the sake of art, that we've created art in this new mechanism. Is the goal, in your opinion, of generative art to be anything more than an artistic expression? As a prior coder many, many years ago, and not a particularly good one, but I would argue that coding is separate to the enjoyment of art.
If you execute a piece of code that's so efficient, and, you know, some people would claim that that's art, right?
Right. The question is generative art created for the sole purposes of enjoyment or expression, or is it to perform another function? Because almost you, Jax, I'm a film producer, you're an artist.
Yeah, right? The first thing I'd say is it's perfectly fine for it to just be art. There's nothing wrong with things just being art.
Absolutely. Right?
But then also, there's lots of things that things created as just art do in the world. Right. And so one of the things they do is they have a social function. People go to art openings. They talk about it in relation to their lives and their culture. Right. So it has a social and cultural function. And it gives me the possibilities of seeing something new about my culture and society, my history as an individual. All of these things are directions art can go in. Not necessary ones. Right. I mean, if you have sometimes it's nice for the sake of, you know, for instance, Jax, right? Having a concert, you see a bunch of people enjoying themselves. They're all there. It's a social event. So great. You know, that's something it can do.
I just thought of something. Jax, you're a little bloody digital. First of all, you're a digital artist, right? Or you hire digital artists. He's got a little miniature digital Jax that's on a screen behind him with 100,000 fans.
But that's video art because it's...
I'm not finished yet. No. I agree with that. But here's the thing. Yeah. I'm going one step further. If you've got your animator to allow him to do things himself autonomously, that would be generative art.
I mean, it's true.
At the moment, he just tells him to walk across the screen. Yeah,
if you become a virtual idol... Right. If you become Hatsune Miku, then you get to transform yourself. It's sort of it's like an extropian dream. It's like uploading yourself to the hard drive. Right. You become the soul
of the visual.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that. There's something about this that just eludes me. Like after you've created the construct.
Yeah.
So it runs itself afterwards. And does the generative art improve?
So
see, I can't get my head around that.
Well, I don't at all have an answer to it, but I will say it's not at all hypothetical, because Harold Cohen developed a generative artist, a system, you know, he referred to it as an artist, but you can think of it as a generative artwork, Aaron. And so Aaron produced drawings, and Cohen kept refining it again and again throughout his life. And eventually he said, oh, well, you know, its use of color is better than mine. It's actually better at this aspect of art. And, you know, we're now in a situation where Cohen has died, you know, several years ago. But Aaron still exists, right?
What?
And is still able to produce artwork, right? And
this is so surreal.
Right, so we have situations like this that already exist. Now, Cohen wasn't trying to create a system that embodies, you know, himself and his own artistic practice. But there are people who do that. Some people are trying to create systems that embody their own artistic practice, like Johannes Helden, like making a project that writes like him, you know, and replaces him as a writer. Okay. So there's
that's the most powerful function.
Is that for vanity or economics, or what do you think the purpose of that is?
I mean, it's sort of like as a computational artist. So, you know, there's always the suggestion that they give to writers. They say, write about something you know, right? So if you're a computational artist and you're trying to make a writer, you know, well, program about something you know. Why not make yourself, you know? Why? I mean, that's the writer you know best, right?
Whoa.
But it performs some useful functions, right? Like it's incredible for redundancy, for death in service and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean,
but you can live on.
Yes. So I think that's right. It depends on whether having an immortal artist, right? Of course, immortal artists just become, they're just obsolete for eternity, right? Because you need to be embodied in the present day culture. You need to have relevance to what's going on. You need to be part of what's happening.
It's an incredible question for technology and culture. If you think about it, let's just
we've already gotten from the screensaver to uploading your artistic practice and your consciousness to the computer, right? Just in probably about 5 or 10 minutes.
I was going to say, yeah, exactly. And now we're talking about the future of mankind. No, what I'm saying is, imagine, Jax, that all of a sudden technology got so good that you could take the embodiment of your art, right? And I'm not sure if you're even, imagine this, that you're not even caught in a time warp, that actually your algorithm is growing as a result of your own artistic design. It's the way you think about lyrics, the way you think about themes, the way you think about what's going on. And all of a sudden, 50 years later, your kids, you know, are talking to their kids about your music. You've sadly gone to heaven, I hope, and they're listening to your music, but that music is constantly being generated. That has all kinds of cultural and historical questions.
Yeah,
I argue that that's fairly visionary. That there's something very interesting about that.
Well, I think it's interesting the first time it's done, but the issue of creating generative art that's imitative of human art, right? That's a whole category of artistic development in and of itself. And my interest in generative art is that it's able to do something very alien and uncanny. It's able to do something unusual. It's able to help us inhabit or perceive, at least, some type of alien consciousness. But my work is not supposed to be human-like at all, the stuff that I do personally, and the stuff that I'm interested in viewing, reading, hacking on, you know, looking at the code of, that work is also not producing human-like art. It's producing something that people can still understand. In some way, it resonates with culture in some way, but it's very bizarre in other ways.
Are the artists in generative art, are they typically from computing backgrounds at first and then come and express themselves through that medium? Or do you find artists that have no background in computing just taking up that as well? And then is there a difference in style of output?
Sure. I think...
like neats and scruffies, you know. I feel like the artists would be more scruffy that didn't come from a computing background.
One of the things when Ernest Edmonds did all these interviews with artists, and he found that they fell into these two categories. Mm-hmm. And one category, these are people who they could tell you the moment when the computer changed their artistic practice. So Manfred Moore was someone who was doing stuff, you know, related to abstract expressionism, and, you know, talk with a musician, learned about computing. And there was this moment when it's like, this is it. I have to do this. I'm going to do this type of work. However, a lot of other artists, and I would have to put myself in this category, are people for whom there's no such moment. They were always working with intertwined practices that were artistic and computational. They were always programming as they did their thing as an artist.
Am I right in thinking that if it's not software, is there any blend over to hardware that, that still has a definition to or connects to generative art? I'll give you a great example, a simple example.
Sure.
Banksy, I'm a big fan of Banksy, although I really think that he'll probably be a lot more popular when he's dead because he's not getting out and talking about his art, and most great artists had a chance.
He might be dead, right?
Well, he might be. Somehow I don't think he is, but who the hell knows?
How about announcement of death as the next Banksy artwork? And then we'll get to all read the obits. Right?
Guess what? I own a Banksy. I'd be trying to sell it at that point, right? Or maybe I'll keep it for another year or whatever. The thing that surprises me is that he's revolutionary, and it's not a conversation about Banksy, but I believe that all great artists need in some way to begin that curation. And it will help historians and other curators to talk about their art. And what I'm wondering is that piece, do you remember the exploding piece of art at the auction?
It's the only interesting thing that's happened at Christie's anytime recently. The self-shredding piece. Yeah.
Obviously, the first bit is not generative art, but the process of writing any code to explode or shred, I should say, a piece of art. Is that contained in the definition of generative art?
Well, this is it. So you can think about
that. Was that a code or was it like a physical thing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you can make a machine that does that. I mean, computers are machines. So if you made a computer, if you made a computer to do it, you were making a machine. So, but you could also talk about, like, you know, the fork bomb exhibited at the Whitney, right? Very short piece of code that simply continually produces new processes until the system is overwhelmed and shuts down. Right. So there's nothing interesting about that as a sequence of characters. Like that's not what's interesting about it. It's only interesting when it's put into the context of a software system. And that software system has to run on something. It's ultimately running on hardware. So one of the things about this is that if you think about generative art as algorithmic art, which you could think about it as, I think that's very limiting. I think you're missing out on all the aspects of messiness and materiality that have to do with this artwork being embodied in software systems running on hardware. You know, for instance, I have a piece called Round, and it's an infinite deterministic poem. And in part, it's based on some of the work that Francois Morellet did. There's six paintings that Morellet did that are what I would call sort of visualizations of the digits of pi. And my poem is a textualization of the digits of pi. And so you can read it. Now, you may not want to read it. You may not find it's very sensible. It's somewhat repetitive in terms of the sound. So it has these aspects of internal rhyme. The lines are of varying length and so forth. And as you run this program, as the the program runs itself, as the program runs, it becomes harder and harder to generate the next digit of pi. It takes longer and longer. It takes more and more memory. So on a real computer, it will eventually crash. It's not going to actually work forever. But also, as you start running this, your fan will turn on, like your computer will start to heat up. You know, your fan will turn on, and this piece of generative literature will highlight, I hope, for whoever is experiencing it, that you have a machine in front of you that can actually get hot as it labors, as it works. And I made that software system run on hardware. Only if it's running on hardware. If it were running off at, in Amazon Web Services, you wouldn't get to hear the fan.
What does that make you feel when you have that piece of artwork, when you're observing that?
I mean, for me, it's a reminder that the computer is a machine, that it is material, and it's a way of exhibiting that.
Fair enough.
To mm-hmm. others, and sharing that quality of the computer with others. So that's a system that has, you know, software and hardware as part of it. I think very much.
Yeah, it's like art means something to everyone differently, right? We all have that view. So, but your inspiration, I'm interested in this thing you've created. Is it really the inspiration behind it was to just emphasize or show people that this thing can wear out a computer, and was that your design?
I mean, I read it aloud also. I mean, it produces a text that is.
So how did you assign words to each digit?
Oh, so that I got to choose, just like Morley chose whether, you know, white would be even or black would be odd or whatever else.
Got you. So that's the creative element to it.
That's you. From my standpoint, yes. I don't consider that I managed to completely eliminate or abstract myself, that I am a Zen Buddhist obviating, you know, my own existence completely. There's some of me that's in that process.
Well, I would argue that there's a running cost to your art.
Do you supply the computer too if I buy it?
There's a maintenance bill.
No, yeah. When I exhibit, so it has been exhibited in a gallery context, and in that case, yeah, I you know, I put a computer there, mm-hmm. right? So that's provided. But if you want to run it on your computer, I think that's good too, because then it tells you something about your computer.
So would you say when we use like a Snapchat filter or an Instagram filter that like changes something on our face or something like that, and you get different parts of it as well, like sometimes it can generate a result that's specific to the person mm-hmm. Taking the picture, is that a form of generative art?
Yeah, so...
Oh, so the bunny ears, oh, it's cool.
I would say filters for Snapchat, Instagram, Zoom. I don't know. I guess my question, I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule it out. My question is, whenever someone asks something like that, you know, I give you the stock response, but I think a very useful response is to say, well, how does it help us think about this thing if we imagine it as generative art, right? Like,
yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
You know, so like if we think about the screensaver as generative art, that helps us. The filters are, they do something autonomously, but they don't have that much autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I would probably think to categorize it differently, but one thing that is important is, you know, not to not to dismiss it because it's mass cultural, and not to dismiss it because mm-hmm. it takes an image and transforms it into another image.
How do we get people to recognize generative art as something distinct from more mainstream art that they might think of? So most people would say art in the creative field and think of people like Jacques, or and then in the traditional art, they may think of a painter, Right. Then you've got this, especially with people and NFTs and a $60 million painting, all of a sudden everyone's thinking, Jesus Christ, I can just get my iPad pen out now and start drawing and make money. So there are these vast interpretations of what art is, but how do we shine a lens on generative art? And has there been any, and the two-part question, has there been any big use case examples of famous art that's either been sold or people that are using this medium in a mainstream way? Is that a fair question, Nick?
Sure. I'm not sure that art getting sold, it does get it in the news. There's a lot of issues. There's a lot of institutional issues around what people see as art or not. If you go into a bookstore and you go to the art section of that bookstore, you're probably going to find almost everything there is about painting, some of it about sculpture. You might be able to find a book or two on video art, but even there, very little, right?
Yeah,
how much are you going to find? How much are you going to find on performance art?
Yeah,
right. Very little, and I mean, music is its own section. Mm. So music is isolated from art in that regard. I don't know that being collectible is the only way forward or the major way forward for the recognition of what digital art is. So performance art, for instance, you know, isn't collectible in a traditional way, and conceptual art isn't collectible in a traditional way. Nevertheless, there are these artistic practices that that aren't collectible in the same way. They don't sell in the same way. But they've gotten some purchase, some awareness. I would say people are more aware of performance art than they are of digital art, new media art, because people engaged in the promotion of computing don't care about the fact that there are poetic, aesthetic, artistic dimensions to what you can do as a programmer. Very often they do not care.
I think of things that find their ways into exhibitions and ultimately into big museums, the Whitney, MoMA, Met, whatever, they tend to have one of a few things in common. They tend to have historical context, right? So they're like, this is significant because it's Da Vinci and it's in the 1500s. You're like, oh, Jesus Christ. There's only a handful of paintings. We've got to show it, right? And it happens to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever. The other one is that for some reason, we are interested in someone's career and what they've done or a particular thing they pioneered, a particular brushstroke, and it's worth a lot of money. And so it finds its way in a museum. But I wonder if people are exhibiting this type of medium, if there's no value and there's not much history around it, it's because it's performing a greater function, like it's telling us something or informing us about, the effects of computerization or just this opportunity to discover life in a different dimension, this curiosity with, the example of the screensaver or the example of what you're doing with poetry. Right, not anyone has to read it, but there's actually a purpose behind it.
But there are other types of art, right? There's public art, where it's commissioned, right? It's placed outside. Yep. I mean, one of the questions related to digital art and generative art is that's an important question to sort of take a step back, like what's happening as far as it being for sale, which there has been a famous auction. There have been famous shows in museums. And galleries. But to take a step back from that, you can say generative art, well, should it be for sale at all? And should it be in museums at all? Right? Like, why doesn't it just run in your web browser? Like, everybody has a web browser. So, in fact, if you put it in a museum, and I saw, the programmed exhibit fairly recently at the Whitney, a beautiful exhibit of computational and television-based artwork, video, as well as software art. But one of the things for sure is when you have a flat panel, with some software art running on it, or a projection of software art running on it, you can't view source. You can't see the source code there, right? You're not allowed to do that in the museum. If it's in your browser, you can. And so actually, all of the generative unfolding artworks are free software. They are explicitly available for anyone who wants to study, modify, distribute. You can create your own project based on one of those works. There's restriction that you need to share alike. You need to give back to the commons what you've done. And you can't claim that the original authors, the original artists, endorsed, you know, your particular project. And the code is all available. You know, it's up there for you to look at. And so since the medium of this work is code, we're talking about how the code is the paint, right? In this case, if we stick it in a museum and show you the output of the system, but you can't actually, you know, see the paint. You can't actually see the artwork.
No, you can't. Yeah, right? It's just the outcome. Yeah, yeah. Right. You're seeing the back page of the book, but that's it.
Yeah. So maybe the museum and the gallery is not the ultimate place for this type of work, even though there have been many great shows and it's brought a lot of this work to the attention of the public.
What I feel like what Martin was trying to get at is there an example of a generative art hit? One way you'd categorize that in the art world is something that sold for millions, or some prestigious artist that isn't around anymore, or something like that. Or we talk about Banksy with notoriety like that. In the generative art doesn't have to be given a monetary value for it to be considered important. But is there one that lives on our browser that took over the world at one point in time?
I don't think there's an example that sort of comes to the. It's there's not like you know. The Damien Hirst shark,
or the Salvatore Mundi, or something,
right? Of computer generated art,
right?
Maybe right now, but there's things that are very popular. Many of the examples, I think, do come from more popular culture or mass culture, like the screensaver or John Conway's Game of Life, for instance, right? So that's an example of something. There's work. I don't want to start dropping names because I'll drop some people's names and
you'll miss some and they'll be like, what the hell?
Look at the exhibit. We've got people, and the exhibit has people who are not actually the usual suspects of generative art in most cases. And, you know, one of the things I'd say more recently, because we're talking about the social function of art, we said one of the things art does is it gives us an opportunity to get together in a context in which we could always go out for drinks, throw a party or whatever else, but it gives us an opportunity to get together and think about things aesthetically and think about things in their relationship to our culture and talk about work. And so, for instance, Casey Rees had a recent show of generative art called Social Codes, and it had an art opening online. And I was able to attend this art opening, and he had people in the show that he curated, you know, from around the world. He lives in Los Angeles. I don't see him in person very much, and I, you know, wouldn't have been at the opening if it were an in-person opening. So I consider that a successful outcome. And Generative Unfolding similarly had an opening where people were able to join from all over. And the artists, many of whom I had not met before, you know, I got to talk to by video, face-to-face. That's not the direct answer to your question in that, you know, there's a mega hit generative artwork, but it does address, I think, the success of these pieces.
Is there a way to view generative art you know, when you go, if you view art in a museum, you know, you've got, there's a way they present it. So it's the best way to observe it. Is there a way to, do you have to have the best screens for it to attend these openings?
Well, I think the best way is to be able to access the code and to be explicitly allowed to modify the code, to change things about not just the parameters, but even how it is computationally these artworks function, you know, in most cases.
Yeah.
It's an unusual mix, and aesthetically, visually very diverse. Many of the pieces are very interactive. And so I'd say from my standpoint, it's more that there's shows that are meaningful. Kate Voss Gallery in Zurich had a show called The Game of Life.
I'm just looking at The Game of Life now. I've never heard of it. It looks so interesting.
So these are you know, I think these are some of the classics, but of course no museum owns that, right? That's actually and the source code is definitely available for that, right? That's a and it's been re-implemented. I mean, that is,
yeah, you can play it right here in my Safari.
Oh yeah, you can run that. If you think Doom runs on runs on your camera and on a lot of platforms, I mean, The Game of Life even more so. Yeah.
It seems to me, to come back to your question, Nick, about perhaps museums or perhaps collectibles is perhaps not one particular dimension to necessarily think about where this might end up, and ultimately museums may not be the best place to exhibit it. But it seems to me that something like this, an algorithm that's strongly tech-centric, that has to be given a life of its own in some way in order to generate itself, deserves to live out in the ether.
Sure, sure. In defense of museums and galleries as spaces for the exhibition of this work, they're great places to talk about it. So when I go with some friends, when I go to an opening or when I go with, you know, some friends, then physically being at a space, going to the exhibit, or having a curator or artist who's able to show the work to me there, that's great. But Martin, you were asking about the sort of question of how at MIT, which does have a reputation for being interested educationally, maybe in the bottom line and so forth, right? How do you get people to find things like generative art compelling, right? Well, so, MIT also recognizes the value of basic research, I would say, most often in the sciences. And it's not always easy for basic research to be recognized. I think my colleagues in the sciences have their own challenges and difficulties. So I won't pretend that they don't face any problems. I think engineering is king at MIT in a lot of ways. But people recognize that we need to keep on exploring and thinking and devising theories, building models and testing them, independent of the particularities of how to do engineering or how to accomplish the immediate goals that we recognize. So from that standpoint, I don't think generative art is basic research. I don't think it needs to be characterized as research. Some people do talk about artistic research. Some people have this concept, which is fine. But I think that the artistic areas of exploration that we can get into through work in generative art and the ways that generative art can show what the possibilities of computation are quite valid, quite important, should be happening alongside other types of computational work. So we shouldn't exile them to say, let the art school do that. But here we're a tech school, so we're going to do the technology. No, I think we need to understand a lot of different things about technology. That's my perspective, and students are often enthusiastic.
I wonder what will turn this subject into something that appears or could look too scholastic for the average person. If we were to fast forward 10 years or 15 years, mm-hmm. what might we expect from generative art? And I'll give you, I'm going to throw a couple of things out there. One of them is that we detool ourselves. And just like, you know, we went to plain English in programming, right? We went through 4GL, right? Right way to OpenGL, and we didn't all of a sudden, it's not that the complexity went away, but the languages, and we use things like frameworks to try and make it easier. We try to get more people into programming. Now I'd argue that software is eating the world and that most people want some kind of career in technology and often software. Mm-hmm. But could we see a detooling or just a wider acceptance of the arts and more people get to do what you just said, a level of programming? Or is it that we could see that actually the different applications for generative art proliferate to other kind of byproducts or functions? Or is it that we're going to use other mediums, you know, for instance, if we need to have a physical presence, then we'll use the marketing of a festival or a museum. We'll use NFTs if we want to look at ownership and all these different things that might shine a light on generative art. I mean, if someone's out there with their crystal ball thinking about generative art, what would you like to see or do you think might happen?
Yeah. Well, look, thinking 10 or 15 years out, what I'd say about the arts, right, is everybody writes. Mm-hmm. Everyone has written a poem, a story. Everybody does that growing up, right? You may do it better or worse, but you have the experience. You've tried it out. Mm-hmm. Everybody has sung. Mm-hmm. You may be better or worse. You may not be able to stay in key, on tune. Okay.
Everybody's danced,
right? Everybody has drawn. Everybody has drawn something. Everybody has drawn something, right? So when you talk about how is it that people are able to appreciate visual art, well, part of how they appreciate visual art is that they've drawn something. They've made some visual art. It went on the refrigerator, at least, you know, or whatever else, the AGA or wherever you put it.
The AGA. That's a good one. That's a really good one. Jax is completely confused by it.
No, yeah, I know what that is. Do. I know what that is. It slipped me. And now I see where you're at. That was very good, Professor Nick. Now I can see.
But you know, so the idea, I think really fundamentally, if people want to make this one of the artistic practices amongst other artistic practices, you know, people have to program. And in fact, a huge, huge number of people programmed in the late 1970s, early 1980s. Millions of people. And people didn't learn it because they were doing Google Summer of Code or because they wanted to do STEM education or they just tried it out just for the sake. Then they, you know, just for the sake of trying it out and often for artistic sorts of purposes, you know, type in a little poetry generator or a little version of Eliza, the chatterbot, or, you know, a little sort of game.
I mean, do you think, speaking about today's young people that appreciate art and the rise of street art and all and that kind of side of things and how that, you know, you look at Instagram artists that have become big and have huge cult followings like and generate value off of hype rather than perhaps the processes mm-hmm. that go into something. Do you know what I mean? Like it's hype. It's like Alec Monopoly springs to mind in all of this, right? It has a different flavor. It feels a bit more of a sharing platform for other things to happen. Perhaps it's a social construct, something for us to look at, you know, something just for the sake of existing. Do you think then it will catch fire in the future in the same way if it doesn't have that air of exclusivity that things that nowadays things need to have? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, one of the places where you see work that is fundamentally, it's a software system. It involves computation. Sometimes it's made by an individual or a small team, is in digital gaming. Now, those systems don't run on their own for the most part. There's some exceptions, like like everything. For instance, James O'Reilly's game, where if you just let go of the controller, it'll wait there for a moment and then it'll start playing itself, which is great. It's an amazing game, actually. There are examples of this more mainstream sort of, you know, software system, computer art, generative work is involved in certain cases. We're already getting to a point, though, where with digital games, there's now a very strict sort of policing and defining of what digital games are. They have to go through a certain channel. They're sold on Steam, or else they're made for consoles and they get pressed onto discs less and less often these days.
So
digital games are very well defined. This is what they are. And of course, the art world has its own institutions as to what you do to define that stuff. So it's hard to make these connections and things that are in the gap. And there are people like Tracy Fullerton working with Bill Viola, who's quite famous and excellent as a video artist, to create The Night Journey, right? So there's something that is a video game-like interactive experience. It's not computer-generated art, but it's something that bridges the art world and the video game world in a certain way. And then, Tracy Fullerton has another game about Thoreau's experience in Walden, which is a non-conventional, sort of experience. I think there's a lot of things happening. I don't think many of them, they're not in academia in any way. They did bachelor's degrees, but, their involvement is a lot scrappier with this type of stuff. So I think there's a huge number of different players, and each of them bring different things to the table.
I would argue that there's a correlation for generative art with prosperity, with productivity, and I'll tell you for why. And ultimately, it's progress because of one thing: greater application of programming. Right. So if there's more programming, there's a number of things that are happening in the world. Right. We're likely to see prosperity and productivity. But what could we see directly that's not correlative that's come as a result of generative art? So, for instance, it seems to me that it could serve as a very different way to coin a term, think different, to solve problems a different way, a different way to look at code, a different way to feel inspired, a different way to look at life. I wonder whether these kind of skills or practices could come from more people being immersed in generative art.
You've answered your own question. We both know that that's the case. And let me ask either of you or both of you, if you think there's a distinction between an artist and a designer, which some people don't, how would you distinguish those two?
Typically, a designer would be something for function.
Yeah.
See, in its broadest definition, I don't distinguish the difference.
Okay. Right? Martin, you've got like the John Maeda view of artist and designer, and Jax has, I think, a more traditional idea that which Charles Eames, I think, would also say that the designer has a problem, and the artist doesn't have a problem. So you could, whether you're doing industrial design or graphic design or whatever else, you can successfully solve the problem. But the artist doesn't have to, but also can't, right? And so one of the things there is there are approaches that are appropriate in both cases. Like you might want to quickly come up with 20 different ideas if you're a designer, and you might also do the same thing if you're an artist. But ultimately, you have to solve the problem from the design standpoint. And from the art standpoint, your purpose is to explore, and you might find a sort of problem along the way. But I like to say that in the arts and humanities, rather than answering questions, our job is to generate new questions, right? And the whole idea of this exploratory programming for the arts and humanities is that we don't start from a specification the way you say, this is how an ATM works, or a cash point. Yeah. This is how a cash point works. Now write the code, implement the cash point. Leaving that aside, we also need to explore. We also need to use computation to think in new ways. So programming and computation is a way of thinking. It's a means of thinking about the world. And there is the exploitative thinking where we know what we are going for and we exploit our existing knowledge to reach the goal. But there's also the exploratory thinking.
Do you envisage someone like myself owning generative art? Like in the future?
How about producing it?
For myself.
Yeah, actually, producing it is a better question. I'm much more interested in the question of will you produce it than in the question of will you own it. So my next book, Exploratory Programming for the Arts and Humanities, second edition, is coming out in a month, in just under 1 month. It is going to be open access, freely available book. It's in print, so you can buy a print copy, which I think is a great way to learn to program, just like in the old days where you were able to take your manual or your programming book and open it up and stick it next to your computer.
That's how I did it. Yeah, yeah, exactly. The old days.
This book is designed for that. This book is designed to do that. My own concerns aren't so much about models of ownership, but more models of engagement. And I'd say if you want to really understand what generative artwork is and you want to think about it and appreciate it deeply, you should be a programmer. Not a professional programmer, not somebody who has a computer science degree or works for Google or Microsoft or something, but someone who's able to use computation, someone who knows what iteration is. You know, what's a for loop? What's a function? What types of a variable are? Things like that. True basics. And once you do that, you're able to move ahead in a powerful way, thinking about and working with computation and exploring it as an artist if that's a direction you wish to take.
Guys, thanks for listening. We're now 10 shows into our journey to learn new things across life, business, and art with intellectually curious people at the top of their field. I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as we are. We've spoken to entrepreneurs, athletes, musicians, journalists, composers, and we're only getting started. The whole point of this is to engage with you, our audience, and bring you along for the ride. So head to our website to sign up to our mailing list. It's jacksandmartinshow.com, or WhatsApp your comments to the producers. All the details are below. See you next time. Roll safe.